Should we just, we'll go ahead and pass the mic around as well. So I'm going to take this mic and we'll hand around. We can start over here. And if people want to, maybe we'll start in the back and we'll move it forward. Just say your name and why you're here.
Michael Harrington from Chicago, chairman of Green Chicago Party. And I'm Jeffrey Kovich, the secretary of the Illinois Green Party.
I'm Mel Figueroa from Green Party of California. This is my broader campaign and News Network.
I'm Jillian Thomas, and I'm with YWCA Southern Arizona, as well as Stein Baraka.
Hi, I'm Carol Bidwell from South St. Paul, Minnesota. What else am I supposed to say?
Why are you interested in being here?
Because I'm interested in what's going on. And I was a Bernie Sanders supporter.
I'm Jim Calvert from Kentucky, and I'm here to learn.
I'm Bruce Berlin from Santa Fe, New Mexico, with the New Mexicans for Money Out of Politics, and author of Breaking Big Money's Grip on America, and I think and hope the incorruptibles have a way to help do that.
I'm Carol Hearn, and I'm from Kentucky, and I was a Bernie supporter, and I no longer have any illusions about our government. So therefore, I'm convinced we're going to have to start over and fight for a representative democracy, and I'm here to get as many tools as I can.
Hi, I'm Lance Smith. I'm from San Francisco, California, and I am here to just learn more about how to uncorrupt the government, because we have a very corrupt local government in San Francisco.
And look in the back, there's
I'm Dave Schwab, and I'm here from Madison, Wisconsin. So we have local elections coming up, and just always looking to hear more perspectives about how to build power from the grassroots up.
Lovely. You guys have a mic? You want to just
sit down? So I'm Matt Kozlowski from Madison, Wisconsin. I work with the Jill Stein President campaign, and previously I served as the co-chair for Progressive Dane, which is the second party in Madison and Dane County.
I'm Elizabeth Glidden. I'm the vice president of the Minneapolis City Council, and I'm also a board member of Local Progress, which you're going to learn a little bit more about. It's a membership organization for progressive local elected officials.
The one newcomer.
Thank you.
Oh, the two newcomers.
Yes.
Well, yeah, everybody's just introducing
this,
your name and.
Okay. I'm Steve Tuckner, and I'm with Our Revolution Minnesota.
Great.
Oh, I'm Gar Alpervitz at the Next System Project from Washington, D.C.
Thank you. So you want to say your name and.
I'm Terry Weeks with National Nurses United. I'm from Florida.
All right. Thank you, everyone. What was that?
A lot of travelers.
A lot of travelers, yeah. People who are not necessarily from Minneapolis, so that's great. I'm Anna Callahan. I'm from Berkeley, California. And I am the founder of the Incorruptibles, one of the co-founders. So I'll be talking about that in a bit. What we're going to do is we'll have a little presentation on the Incorruptibles and what we're doing. Then these folks are going to, I have a little questions for people in the audience. Then we'll have a video from Local Progress. These folks are each going to talk about their organizations and experience. And then we'll have a nice long Q&A session. So So the Incorruptibles is very new. We started in May. We launched in May. And our long-term mission is to sort of fill all levels of government with what we affectionately call Bernie Sanders. I have a tattoo of Bernie Sanders on my shoulder. It's my only one. But really, because even if you aren't a Bernie Sanders fan, like, he's a symbol of a person who represents the 99% and the vulnerable, and who really remains consistent in his viewpoints and in doing that over 30 years. And that's the kind of person that we want to fill our government with. So that's our long-term goal, and we do it by really base building, building a base of progressive power in cities. So we're focusing right now on municipal elections. So here's a question. Why did Bernie's campaign spread like wildfire?
He had passion.
He had passion. His message.
His movement.
His message.
He was authentic.
Authentic.
There was a movement of people who self-organized because they believed in the values.
Ah, the values and people self-organizing.
I think he said stuff, well, sort of left Trump. He said stuff that other people just simply wouldn't say. Okay, no, I'm not comparing to Trump in that sense, but I mean, for example, I never ever heard a politician of almost any stature say, you know, we need to go after the billionaires. The billionaires. Nobody says that. That's what I think, to say stuff that's unsayable.
Speaking truth to power.
Right.
Right? Yes.
I was a Bernie Sanders delegate, pledged to the convention from Chicago. I'm elected on the ballot with several of my, from my neighborhood. Bernie spoke to truths for us in our neighborhood and our community that the other parties were not speaking, the other candidates were not speaking to truths, honestly, about our experience, challenges, problems, dissatisfaction with the way things are. That, you know, the people were organized already, focused on that message. Bernie simply showed up and spoke to what was already on our minds and on our time.
Yes, so he followed sort of the Occupy movement and a bunch of other movements, and yet he was authentic because you could see videos of him from 10, 20, 30 years ago saying the same thing. So he spoke the same truths, but it wasn't just lip service, right? It was real, and you knew that he would actually pass policy on that, those truths that he was speaking. Yeah.
I think Bernie spoke to people, whereas other candidates, maybe not the orange one, but most of them spoke to polls. You get the idea, okay, we want this individual to be president, let's do some focus groups, let's take some polls, and find out what people are interested in, and then our candidate will talk about them, whether they're interested in them or not. Instead of letting it happen in organic and talking to people.
We're talking to real people instead of polls. Yeah, absolutely.
And I want to add also, although I introduced myself earlier as chairman of the Chicago Green Party of Chicago, Bernie was able to communicate that message, but he wasn't the only one on that message. I believe Jill Stein was on that same message.
Yep.
And other candidates have been on the message before. He had the visibility, the connected, and he had whatever came together. It made him more prominent than other people with that message.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting point that he, and that's why I asked this question, which is he was actually only, I think, known by 3% of the population of America when he first started, when he announced his run. So he wasn't a national presence. Like, we think of him now as a national presence, but he wasn't at that time. How did he go from there to where he ended up at the end of that campaign? And I think a lot of these questions are, these answers are, in fact, the right answers. Go ahead.
The Democrats, we'll forget about the Republicans, but the Democrats then, under auspices of the Clintons and other horrible people, were busy saying we have to save the Affordable Care Act, which of course was an insurance plot to block single payer, and supporting the war industry by threatening us with a terrible Russia and North Korea. And I have yet to awaken in the morning, fearful that the noise I heard was a North Korean or a Russian coming into my bedroom. But they were promoting the same old, same old. And Bernie is a character. And I think the population was ready for a different kind of person. Jill Stein is fabulous, but she still looked like a normal human being that isn't very tall.
That's true.
And then we had Bernie, this crazy guy with a New York accent. Vermont, and Orangehead, and these were characters, and people were ready for something close to a caricature and just be different. So I don't mean to insult Bernie by calling him a caricature, but he's different.
Yeah, and so this is a really, this is another great point. And I think the point that you're making is society has come to a place, and the two parties have come to a place where the two parties are going that way, and society is going this way, and things are coming to a head. And because of Occupy, because of these other previous movements, Bernie spoke to the truths that we all are becoming aware of, and he managed to do so at the right moment, with the right message. He did not seem like a standard politician. So I think all of these things are accurate, but at the core were the first things people mentioned, the values, the message. Those things were absolutely core, and his integrity. So these things are core to I think his success. Yeah?
Okay, so the one thing that really struck me is just uncanny and interesting is that Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn are so alike, right? They're both like progressives from the 60s who just like came out of, you know, they were like unfrozen from the tundra, right? And both of them were, neither of them were your standard politician charismatic, right? Like you look at Macron, right? Here's your standard charismatic guy, and after I think a month or so he's been in, his poll values have dropped like 10%. They're dropping so fast because people are realizing that's why there's an attraction to Bernie and to Corbyn, is because they're not looking for anybody that's slick, because they've been sold slick politicians for a generation who did nothing for them.
That's right. So the next question, of course, is how can we create more of these people? How do we create authentic people with real values who are going to stick to those values, and who, somebody mentioned having like the support, right? Having a support network, who have a support network, because that's crucially important. Bernie tried to run for office how many times before he got elected as mayor?
Twice.
Four times.
Four times.
What did he run for?
Mayor.
Nope. Senator twice and governor twice. What's the highest vote percentage he got during all four of those? 5%. Right. He got 1%, 2%, 4%, and 5% on those four elections, and not in that order. So he could not leap in at the national level. Right?
You can't.
Nobody can. So that's nobody. I think people do, but those people take a lot of corporate money. So progressives, maybe not how we want to define that, we can define it, but it is super difficult for those people to do that. So here's that question. Oops. How do we create thousands of these people? How do we do that? Right? And yeah?
Is it create or identify and support?
Yes and yes. Uh-huh. It is all of those. I think that it is a question of cultivating, supporting, helping these people to realize that elected office is a thing that they can do. I mean, I think there's a whole question of what does it mean to create, right? Obviously, we're not giving birth to them, so we're not creating in that sense, but yes, really in every possible way, how can we bring as many of those people out of our communities and put them into positions of power? And that is what elected offices are. They are the strongest positions of power in our society. They control everything, taxes and, anything you can talk about. Like if it was filled with thousands of Bernie Sanders, then we would not be here, right? We'd be having a very different discussion. So we thought a lot about this, and I'm just going to quickly go through a presentation of our answer. I've actually gone through this with other groups where they have come up with ideas, and many of them end up in here. I'm going to go through it quick so we can get to our panelists. But What we do is based on the success of the Richmond Progressive Alliance. How many people here have heard of the Richmond Progressive Alliance? So less than half, okay? I'll give a super quick background. Richmond, California, town about, city about 120,000 people, was basically under the rule of Chevron for about 100 years. Chevron had one of the largest oil refineries in the country in Richmond. They paid off every politician. In the 90s, they actually had a desk inside City Hall. Every 10 years or so, there would be a spill or an explosion that would send hundreds of people to the hospital, would damage the environment. They had the second highest murder rate in the country, terrible police brutality problems, a lot of low-wage workers. A very troubled city. And in 2003, the Richmond Progressive Alliance was just a group of people that got together and decided that they had had enough and they were going to take over their city government. So what they did was a lot of the things that I'm going to talk to you about. And in a pretty short span of time, over about a dozen years, they not only got a two-term Green Party mayor, who would still be mayor right now if there weren't term limits, but they also have a supermajority on the city council. They've reduced their homicide rate by 75%. They now have one of the top community policing police departments in the entire country. They've successfully sued Chevron for many millions, tens of millions of dollars for damages, both health and environmental damages. They passed one of the first rent control laws in California in 30 years. So they literally have changed the lives of their residents in amazing, amazing ways against incredible odds. And in 2014, Chevron spent over $3 million trying to defeat their candidates. And the Richmond Progressive Alliance won. So that's the model that we base our recommendations off of. And what we do is we have
and a national group. So the local chapters, they obviously are going to run candidates. They pool campaign resources, but even before that, they create coalitions, they do town halls and door knocking, they also canvass a phone bank, they gain experience and name recognition with each election that will remain in the city, rather than dying with any particular candidate. And then after people are elected, they support those elected officials with research, actions, legwork. They act almost as a sort of unofficial city commission to help those progressive politicians get policies passed. The national group, we have campaign training. We connect the local organizations with the national network. We also want to have like a network of sitting incorruptible mayors and city councilors, and we're going to hear a lot from Local Progress about that kind of organization. And we're playing a long game. We want people who we hope some of these people will eventually run then for state and for national offices. So we're, again, in mind, we're trying to create the types of people that will be able to change our entire government and not just at the local level. So steps in doing that, we have a guide, and I'll have a link to that. It'd be great if you would download that. So you form a core team, you have a membership. When people join, what's the most important thing to understand about this part of it is that it's going to be a democratic organization. So the people, anyone who's a resident of your city or county can be a member, and they can vote on the platform, the candidates. Then we do have two principles you have to agree to. Number one is that none of your candidates can take any corporate money at all. We feel that's core. And that we are post-partisan. That doesn't mean that your candidates can't run under a party. Your candidates are going to run under, you know, the party that makes the most sense for them. But we feel that it's important for the group itself not to affiliate itself with a party, because then it outlaws any other party from being part of this coalition. And the point is that it is, in fact, a genuine coalition of all of the progressives and really all of the people who deserve to be represented in your city. Do you have a specific question?
How do you define corporate money?
Currently, we define corporate money as, that's kind of a long and interesting question. The simple way is simply that we don't take money from corporations. So unions, yes. Corporations, no. Individuals who happen to work at corporations, yes.
But of course, in every city it's going to be different. As far as our strict national rule, it's simply direct money from corporations, which I hear is already illegal in Minnesota. Bravo. Well done. It's a very important thing to pass. Right. Right. But anything, even small businesses, we just say corporate money is not for us. So this is a phrase straight from the Richmond Progressive Alliance, run by organizing and organized by running. So the idea is that if you are a Lone Ranger candidate, and you're not running out of an organization, then the experience ends up dying with your campaign, whether you win or lose. The name recognition is only about you. You don't really have support after you're elected. And volunteers, they end up having to look for another candidate next time around. But if instead you begin by focusing on the local chapter rather than focusing on the candidates, the experience remains in the community. So even if you lose an election, the chapter learns. It learns about, you know, why that particular candidacy won or lost, who was pouring money into the opposing campaign, all sorts of things that you can use in the next election. Name recognition builds in the community because, you know, for the Richmond Progressive Alliance, everyone in Richmond now knows about that organization and what it stands for. The group can act as kind of an unofficial commission after the person is elected, so you have a lot of support afterwards. And then volunteers can simply be attached to this organization and continue to work with every one of their candidates and all of their slate of candidates. Building a coalition is crucially important. So this might be with unions, with NGOs, service organizations, other progressive organizations, churches, community organizations, opinion makers who comment, you know, who come to city council meetings, make comments in social media or newspapers. And really you'll see that we reach even beyond. This is sort of the choir. So you start off with the choir, working with the people that you know are gonna agree with what you're doing, but we reach out beyond that as well. We do something that we call continuous town halls, and we added the word continuous on because we really think that this is something that needs to happen year-round, every year, once or twice a month. So the organization should be reaching out to specific sets of constituents. So don't have a town hall in City Hall and expect people to come to you. What you do is you decide, I want to hear from that coal mining town, or I want to hear from students. I want to hear from senior citizens. So you go to places where they already are. You find out, you know, you want to reach your church where you know that your African American community really comes and where there are leaders there that could reach out words from that community as well. And you have some agreement with the leadership that you can come to them. And then when you do that, you spend 80% of the time listening. So it's really about learning what your constituents need. And this will be done by candidates, but it really should also be done by the organization. To not only learning from is the most important part, but once you've listened to people and you've talked about proposals that you could do that really would help them, that would answer some of their concerns, then you have an opportunity to educate them and to mobilize them. So these are like a critical element that Bernie is known for doing. You can find videos of him doing this with different types of people. And that we think needs to be used more, so that's something that we really recommend. We are working with Les Leopold. So have people seen his book? It's on one of the tables out there. You know, we picked this because if you go see his workshop, he's training 30,000 people to give workshops around the country. And his workshop is really awesome. I highly recommend it for everyone, in part because you don't have to be knowledgeable of or in favor of any particular thing. You don't have to be an environmentalist, you don't have to be a Black Lives Matter person, you don't have to be LGBT, you don't have to be, you know, you don't have to be for anything, because it's about your pocketbook And it's about how the 1% are stealing money from you. So it kind of hits everybody where it hurts. And he has tested it with people on the left and on the right, with Trump voters and, you know, Hillary, Bernie, like everybody. And he finds that after people attend his workshop, he asks them to answer this list of questions, and it's basically Bernie's platform, and they all are like, yes, 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 yes. So this is what we're starting with as a kind of educational concept. And there are many ways to educate, but this is kind of the one that we've chosen to start with. And then finding candidates. So, you know, we really believe in cultivating candidates versus endorsing. I'm happy to talk more about that later if that's interesting to people. We also provide campaign training. You'll hear me say that like 5 times. But campaign training it's important, and we feel like it's important that the people who know to run campaigns aren't just the candidates, that the community knows how to run a campaign. And you have people within your chapter that know how to do these various roles, so they can step into those roles, not just for one candidate, but for an entire slate of candidates. So you might have an outreach coordinator who does outreach for all 4 of the candidates that you are running in this particular election. So for any of these particulars, you can pool those resources. And then if you have a November election, starting in February for most local elections is pretty early. So we recommend go ahead and start early for the actual, like, announce your slate of candidates and start them running. And again, one of the things that we feel is a crucial element to all of this is building the base. So the group continues to support the coalition in non-campaign season. And that means that in addition to asking those coalition partners to do town halls and those sorts of things, that we actually show up. That each group in there shows up at the other events. So trying to unify from within a municipal circle, right? So we're focusing on the municipal level, and what we are hoping is that each group within the coalition will, you know, support the other groups as well in direct actions and in all of those other ways. And then we also, again, support the elected officials with research, legwork, and actions. And that's it. So my one ask for people is that you go to this address, is theincorruptibles.us, and it's with an I. Sometimes people spell it with an A, but theincorruptibles.us/guide. It will put you on our newsletter, and it will also give you access to our guide, which gives very specific instructions on how to start a grassroots chapter in your community. So that is that. And what I was hoping to do was hand out these. Oh, I wouldn't mind. Here's a stack of them. There's more. And just kind of go through these questions. Did you have a question?
Well, I was just going to say, like, while you were talking about, like, you know, being able to listen to different constituents and stuff, something that I found that was really effective for Bernie, and it was kind of something that Obama had started, but Bernie really took to the ground with it, is that he created a Native American committee that was, you know, his advisory board, but at the same time, we were helping organize on the ground. Because a lot of the stuff that we ended up doing was volunteering, you know, so we had different people we could call and check in, and so we were all on the same message each time that we went out and talked to the community. But he also brought in a tribal liaison who did the tribal outreach coordinating. And if you noticed, or if you're watching on social media, he'll have he always had a clutch meeting before going to these big cities. And what he ended up doing was bringing in local tribal leadership and sat down and had an hour meeting with everybody. And I mean, I got to sit in there on the one in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And then, well, actually, I had a lot to do with that one, but we actually got to sit down and ask him personal questions, you know, about what the issues were going on in South Dakota. And he did that with majority of the cities on his stop along the way, because what the state parties and the DNC doesn't realize is that
you need to like, you know, I wish I'd given it to you at the beginning.
One thing that people don't realize is that the
the general idea of the Native American vote is to only pander to it when they think that they need it. So in our state party, and then, you know, for the national things too, and they only come in maybe like the 60 days leading up to our primary. It's like the only attention that we get. And like right, myself right now, my name is Allison Renfield. I'm here with Dakotas for America. We're a public action committee in, or a political action committee in South Dakota. We're going to be running for Lakota for public office and hopefully have a Lakota governor within the next year and a half or so. But we, I was the Bernie delegate, and then made a lot of good connections with his tribal liaison and, like, you know, with his committee and things like that, and we actually organized into Standing Rock. And so we've completely mobilized, and I was just really, you know, really hopeful watching your slide, because we're already doing a lot of the things that you're talking about. So, I myself have been doing this for 15 years, and the people I'm working with have, you know, been in there for 20 years or so too. And the thing that we ended up finding is that Republicans really want to engage, and they want to come out of, you know, that stereotype that they're all country and all these other things. They're, you know, closed-minded people, and they're not. So it's really refreshing to hear you say a lot of the stuff that, you know, you're saying, because it coincides with a lot of the work that we're doing in South Dakota. So, but yeah, I just wanted to say that.
Thank you.
And I want to catch up with you at the end too. Awesome. So if everybody got one of these questions, I actually would love, do people have pens? I didn't bring any. I might have one or two. Do people have pens? I would love to, you know, spend just maybe 5 minutes. I can, you know, walk through these questions and just pick one or two of the questions that really resonates with you and write down the answers for your community. These are the kinds of things that we work with our grassroots chapters on. And so it's things like, who are the more vulnerable people in your community? And what are the demographic groups that you want to represent? So which of those demographics are already represented in your organization, and which are represented in your leadership? And these are questions that, you know, I think people do struggle with. But when you ask directly, then you can say, okay, great. Well, they're not represented. How are we going to make that happen? And then, like, what groups are you in your coalition? Which of those groups have you done a town hall with to learn from them, to learn what their issues are? Like, which of those groups have you invited to do Les Leopold's presentation? Because it's, you know, very, obviously it's just an invite, see if they're interested. But if they are, then a lot of people really love that. And then the questions about power are like, how many elected officials do you have in office now? And do they feel allegiance to your organization? So if they feel like, if that candidate really, the elected official really feels like you are an organization that they have a good relationship with and they want to work with, you're going to have a lot more power than if you simply endorse a candidate and then they, you know, aren't interested in talking to you. And then the final ones are about sort of expanding. So who are the demographic groups that have not supported you, that have not voted for your candidates, that have not joined your organization? And are any of them your natural allies? Like, are any of these people in the bottom 50% of wage earners?
Right.
Probably. And so how can you then reach out? And we have a whole recommended reading list, and one of them is Jane McAlevey's book, No Shortcuts, where she talks about identifying organic leaders. And organic leaders are people who may not agree with you. They may not be in favor of your organization. They may not consider themselves progressive. They may, you know, not X, Y, or Z. They may not be the kind of people that you think will automatically join you. But if you can convince them, they will bring in 100 of their people, because they're someone that people naturally trust in their church, in their workplace, in their, you know, PTA, their community organization. So finding, identifying those people, and then making, listening to them and making the case for why your organization is going to be able to answer their needs. In order, so that we're not always preaching to the choir, right? So we're very big about expanding our base. A question?
How do you define community? For example, in my city, the most vulnerable people in the city are not in my city council district. So are we looking, you know, how are you defining community?
So we define a municipality. And if some of those are district-wide and some of them are not.
Well, then we have a strange system. In the primary, it's someone for the district, but then whoever, the top two candidates, assuming that one doesn't win it outright in the primary, they will vote citywide. So it's a very strange hybrid that way.
There are a lot of different ways that cities run their elections. But we think that what's important is to identify so the members of your chapter, we only allow one chapter per municipality, will be everyone who can vote in that city. So it'll be more than just your district.
Yeah.
We may have to rethink this for places like New York City, where there's literally a district is 120,000 people. So that'll be very interesting, like how do we deal with these giant cities with giant districts? But ideally, and this is the way that the RPA does it, is your municipality is kind of what you're talking about. So everyone in your city is someone who you should be concerned with and should be forming alliances with. People want another minute to write answers or to think about these questions?
I heard a comment that she said when I first walked in is that, you know, what we talked about a lot in Standing Rock, or, you know, there was conversations about it in our organizing meetings, is that right now, you know, you said we have the two parties that are ready to split. Well, actually, and at the same time, you know, luckily for us, we're at a crossroads where all of these different movements are coming together, you know, and it's like if we can somehow, how do we tap into the people who are potentially going off in their own direction to keep, you know, steadfast and keep on going with the rest of everybody, because you have the environmentalists who are now coming together with, like, the, you know, the government type based, you know, movements and stuff too. So I mean, like, how do we kind of keep everything intact and intertwined now moving forward, now that, like, you know, we're all against the same
right government? So I'm going to actually put that question on the board and have that during Q&A. I think what I want to do is show the local progress video and do a little panel with these folks, because they have tons of experience in local politics. And then we'll have plenty of time for Q&A. Okay, so that question is fragmentation. This is unifying. Okay, so I'm going to have to go here. And I'm hoping that the sound comes through as well. I don't know. I should be on the Wi-Fi, so.
Do you want to hit your volume button once, just to make sure that the volume is
on? Something's happening.
It does not appear that there is.
Oh, my computer never does. I know.
Oh, you're turned off. Who turns off the blips? It's the greatest Apple sound.
Just. Oh dear. So while I figure this out, do you guys mind just in your intros, and you feel free to take 5 minutes talk about your group and what you're doing.
Sure, I will. So again, my name is Elizabeth Glidden. I'm the Vice President of the Minneapolis City Council, but I'm really here as a board member of Local Progress. Local Progress is a 501c3 organization that's a membership organization for local elected officials. So our members are mayors, city council members, school board members, county commissioners. And the video we were about to show you is a very newly created C4 part of the organization, because we wanted something that kind of talked about the recruitment end. But really, Local Progress is about supporting people once they are in office. Local Progress is a project of the Center for Popular Democracy. The Center for Popular Democracy does cutting-edge research on progressive issues, and they design campaigns in coordination with base-building progressive organizations. So there may be different organizations per state. In the state of Minnesota, I believe Say Tool is an organization that's a member of Center for Popular Democracy, as well as Take Action Minnesota and Neighborhoods Organizing for Change. I will just tell you, as a local elected official, there is not much out there that connects us to what are the tools that help us feel like we are supported in our work and trying to do cutting edge progressive policy work. My connection with Local Progress is the first time that I felt like I'm really part of a national movement of progressives that is moving different policy areas, and I see myself as more than just someone who's doing different things in the city of Minneapolis. I would say the typical Local Progress member is often someone who isn't really someone who necessarily ran in a conservative district, but someone who probably ran against what they perceived as an establishment candidate, and they were a challenger to that. In the city of Minneapolis, some of the things that we have done that I think really align with Local Progress members, certainly our work recently to pass safe and sick time ordinance. We raised the minimum wage just a few months ago to a $15 minimum wage with no tip penalty. Local Progress right now has four major campaigns that we are trying to get members to participate in. One is fighting on behalf of immigrant rights around a seeking sanctuary effort. We were the first organization to bring cities together in a conference in March to strategize around how do we fight back. We also have an economic prosperity campaign, which is continuing to uplift efforts to do fair scheduling, raise the wage and other things. We have an infrastructure campaign, which is more an effort, I think, to be ahead of this national initiative around privatization. And then the final campaign is around justice and policing practices. So, maybe I'll just save the rest. I don't know what all you want me to do, but I just don't want to take too much time.
No, that's fine.
Okay.
That's totally fine. I'm just, sadly, it's blocking the website.
Okay.
The website is not.
No, that's all right. That's all right. So again, I'll just say that I feel like investing in this part of the progressive infrastructure, how do you support people once they are in office, is just a big missed area. I am hopeful that there are more organizations that get formed like Local Progress. Local Progress right now is starting the work to build more local and regional chapters. And just because you mentioned the Richmond Progressive Alliance, when she was the mayor, Gail McLaughlin was a board member of Local Progress. So that kind of just gives you, for those who know her, an indication of kind of what kind of folks are part of our board. And we just left a national convening of over 130 Local Progress members in Austin, Texas, which happened at the end of July. We chose to go to Austin, Texas, to be able to protest in front of the state capitol their anti-immigrant, anti-sanctuary city law, which is SB4, where they are trying to target local elected officials and sheriffs who dare to oppose an order from the state that you must comply with ICE orders to cooperate. And there's a bunch of lawsuits that are happening right now in the state of Texas around that. So I'm excited to talk a little bit more about Local Progress, but I'll pass the mic to my colleague.
Sure. Woohoo. Am I too loud? Am I good? Okay, cool. So my name's Matt Kaz. I used to work with Progressive Dane. I served as the co-chair of the party and the treasurer a few times, and on the coordinated campaign committee various times over the span of my tenure. But right now I work for the Jill Stein Progressive campaign, trying to bring some of the same model and stuff that we found in Progressive Dane to be really successful to other communities. So Progressive Dane, for those of you who don't know, is a progressive party that's a countywide party that founded in the early 90s in Dane County, Wisconsin, south central right by Madison, in the seat of our lovely power in our state. So it started in the early 90s on the offset of the Farm Labor Party, which was collapsing at the time. There was still some infrastructure of the whole network and local chapters that was functioning, but not really growing and slowly withering out. But a partnership of professors at UW-Madison and community advocates actually got together and said, well, this is something that's valuable, that's dying. We can't allow this to happen. You know, how can we take this infrastructure and turn it into, you know, the kind of La Follette-era progressive party that we wish we still had? So luckily, they got together and built this concept of the New Progressive Party, which was meant to launch as a national sweeping organization that would have local chapters similar in model, I think, to the Incorruptibles nationwide, with Milwaukee and Dane County as really the two flagship chapters for the organization. The awkward bit is it morphed into the Working Families Party later on in many other communities, which has its pluses and minuses, I think, for everyone. But Progressive Dane lingered on long after the New Progressive Party started to collapse or convert into the new party, or into, excuse me, the Working Families Party, which was interesting because it was the contrast between how do you handle a national party model with chapters that wants to focus most on the very most local of elections. The ethos of Progressive Dane has always been that we want to find the elected officials that want to stay in local office and aren't there to climb the ranks. One of the biggest problems we have in Wisconsin is we get elected officials who, you know, want to serve in city council solely for the purpose of getting to state and national office, which in many cases is a lofty goal and something we need. We obviously need to get electeds further up, but what suffers in the meantime are the communities that these local elected officials serve in, where they're just holding a seat in the meantime, waiting to get up to the next rung on the ladder. In many cases, these were the Democrats and Republicans who did not care at all for the politics of the community and got stuck there. So within Progressive Dane, it became the goal to find those electeds who represent our community and will continue to do that job for the long haul, not just to climb the ladder. So I think that's one of the interesting contrasts of finding the way to balance those two things. One, we know we need people in higher office, but how do we make sure that the communities we serve don't suffer along the way? So Progressive Dane, it has an interesting model that I think works well. It's based on the notion that our elected campaigns, our electoral campaigns, are really the afterthought of the rest of the work. The policy campaigns and legislative work and community outreach efforts are the core of everything we do, and getting people elected is a product of that legislative work. So we're most visible not just during election season, but during the legislative season where everyone is supposedly sitting there and in many communities not getting a lot done. Progressive Dane found that, you know, getting people elected was the first step, but you can't get things done if you don't build a legislative effort behind it, build a movement, and get the neighborhoods really engaged in actually making things happen. So that's Progressive Dane. I'll spare you the long-winded history. There's a good article, actually, that conveniently enough just came out a week ago in Jacobin magazine with the title, What Happens If We Win? Which we would hope they would change to What Happens When We Win. But it chronicles the history of Progressive Dane and how, you know, some of these same challenges came about that I think a lot of organizations face now. How do you deal with fusion voting? How do you deal with, you know, community organizations that you agree with what they're fighting for, but you don't agree with their tactics? Or how do you deal with these struggles of, you know, the state laws that will stop your community from getting things done, but not jumping into higher level politics, and so on and so forth. So check out that article. It actually is a really good history of what happened in Madison and why it's a pretty good model for what can happen in other places.
I said one more thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So just as I was listening to you speak, I wanted to tell this a little bit more about what I think is interesting about Minneapolis, because it kind of goes to this issue of building the local power base and how that changes the landscape of what happens in the city. So I've been, I'm not running for re-election. This is my last year as an elected official. I've been elected since 2006. I would say at that point in time, the tradition around here was people would endorse you for your election, but then it was the rare organization that would stay with you and organize around issues. Maybe SEIU was kind of the exception as a progressive labor union that was doing a little bit of that. And I think one of the reasons that I was asked to be a board member of Local Progress when they could have picked people from all over the country was that there was a sense, because I've been a board member there for about 3 years, that
there was a huge change happening in Minneapolis where many organizations, not just one, were transferring their attention to using city ability to make change, to do things that, frankly, in cities we never thought we had the authority to do. And so this hasn't been just an effort that's been happening over the last 2 years. I would say it's really about we're on the four-year trajectory of just a huge acceleration in things where we are pushing the boundaries of what cities in the state of Minnesota have thought we could do. It's not just the earn safe and sick time and the raising the wage that I mentioned. We have also, in this four-year period, passed Section 8 anti-discrimination law. We passed, which was hugely controversial. We just are about to ban menthol cigarettes from stores that are not adult-only stores. We did a plastic bag ordinance, which was targeted by the state legislature, and several other things. So just there's been this huge acceleration, and that never would have happened if we didn't have a big transfer of organizations that used to be focused only on the state legislative process to saying we want to utilize people power in a city like Minneapolis to drive change. So I just wanted to mention that part of the story.
I am so glad that Mel reminded me. I totally forgot Mel. She's going to come up and talk about the municipalism thing that they have a great talk coming up here.
Sure. Actually, let me get to the program. I'm Mel Figueroa. Also been rolling with the Richmond Progressive Alliance too. And this was a great, what reminded me, what you said was like really great in terms of being able to sort of have, local power in many different places. But then there's that scale problem, right? It's the scale of how do you get, above the local? How do you get, alliances across different cities that are experimenting, that are doing great work? Because, a lot of times you can take each kind of city in isolation, but, not have the kind of character of a shared project, the character of a network. And so on Saturday, 1 p.m., I'm going to have a panel with Jack Rabbit Pollock. He has had some experience in Barcelona. But actually, what I really want to plug here is that out of this, we are hoping to get a lot of people who are involved in local politics together to form a national municipalist network so that, it's like sort of locally determined but nationally networked. That way we can kind of have a shared sense of a project and an identity that transcends the local but is also rooted in the local work. So we're hoping to have that meeting Saturday at 6 p.m. In the dorms in Middlebrook Hall on the first floor. So I was hoping to have flyers done by today, but not. I'll be around if you find me. I should have flyers by tomorrow. So if anyone's interested in helping to create a sort of network of local people doing local work, and so that we can share resources, best practices, etc., please hit me up. Thanks.
Thank you.
The one thing that I forgot to bring up before was in connection with the questions that were passed up before, one tactic that we found most successful that I wanted to share was the notion of targeting your community and figuring out the aspects of what makes your area work or tick, or how the politics work or don't work in the community. A big mistake we see with a lot of organizations is they try to make a one size fits all model, which is why I like the Incorruptibles, because you have to acknowledge that certain tactics will not work in communities where you have party locked registration, or you have weak neighborhood associations, or you have disconnected or disorganized communities with no, strong church community or no strong neighborhood community, no political activist groups, and so on and so forth. And I think that's one of the things that we're lucky with Progressive Day and when I came to leadership, because there was 20 years of people before me who spent time each year looking at, okay, what makes this community different from, right next door, from a different state over? And so just in encouraging to look back at the questions again and think about how they apply to your community, that's, I think, one of the strongest lessons that we learned over time was identify your community. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, questions from y'all. And I apologize, I cannot get the video to play. Sorry about that. Yes, go ahead.
I do envy you Enlightened Californians as Midwesterners. Maybe you don't have the problem that we face in Florida. I'm in what is currently one of the most progressive cities in the most progressive county in Florida. And every bloody time we do something, the state preempts it. How do we deal with preemption?
Well, this is a huge issue, and I'll just say, because I just left this conference with other local elected officials, that, you know, that was the issue in Texas.
Yeah.
You know, everything they do is being preempted. We have members there from Arizona. Everything they do is being preempted. And, you know, I'll just tell you what has happened in Minnesota, and some of those lessons translate and some of them don't. You know, we did have the benefit that we have a Democratic governor,
yeah,
but we have a Republican House and we have a Republican Senate, and our governor was not a solid on standing up to the preemption challenge, and we had a tremendous number of bills. What we did do that was effective this year, but this will be a long haul thing, is we had to figure out how do we build interest beyond folks who live in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I think that was sort of the biggest challenge for the organizers, because the governor was clear, you need to bring to me the effort that says this is
a
statewide thing.
We have no allies on the state level at all. We have Rick Scott as our governor, need I say more, because of gerrymandering, the conservative Republicans 100% control the state legislature. We cannot even get bills on the floor or out of committee, if even get on committees, frankly, in the state legislature. It's enough to make you just...
We had a few bills that I feel like went too far, and they ended up being something that smaller cities in the state of Minnesota were finally able to see, as you are interfering in our basic rights to do the most basic things that we want to do. It's like set franchise fees. There's a thing that's a big corporate effort of the cell phone companies that we call the small cell bill, which affects zoning and permitting authority. And based really on those things, not because they liked Minneapolis raising the wage or things like this, we were able to get over 60 cities in the state of Minnesota to pass resolutions saying don't interfere in our local control. Mm-hmm. And so
that is one.
So that was something that was very effective, and it was something that was able, the governor then was able to say, and again, we have a different situation, but the governor was then able to say there's a statewide pressure not to sign this bill that came to me.
Okay. The other thing, too, is don't, and I'm guessing Dave is going to say the same thing I am, but maybe I'm wrong. But the other thing, too, is don't ignore the resources and legal resources that your community has. Wisconsin, we're lucky because of the La Follette era reforms, there is a lot of local control that's built in even when the state preempts a law. So for instance, we can do things through charter ordinances that, you know, seems like an archaic way of legislating around state preemption that actually allow us to get past these sweeping bans. So for instance, in Madison, our biggest problem is we're half renter. Madison is a half renter community. And unfortunately, the landlord interests and real estate interests at the state level have preempted just about all of the reasonable protections for renters that Madison came up with over the years. And now we're scrambling to figure out ways to come up with charter ordinances or legislative campaigns that are, ballot measure campaigns that can actually get around all the preemptions. So the big thing we always say is, honestly, talk to your city attorney if you can and see what they know about how the state law interfaces with your city charter's ability to interface with preemption.
If you have a friend in the city attorney.
And in the long run, like the local movement that I think is starting to be a lot more popular now than it was recently, the local movement will move up to the state level. But it, you know, it's a difficult. I understand, that's true. And there are a lot of, you know, a lot of movement around any gerrymandering as well. So, other questions? Yes.
Okay. I'm in one of the mics.
Thanks.
So, because you were talking about the Progressive Alliance idea, I wanted to raise a point, because I think the way that I see it, one thing that is preventing progressives from working together in a transpartisan way is, well, there's a whole lot of strategic issues, but I think it comes down to the limitations of the current electoral system. So without going into all the details, because I think people are familiar with the issues, I'm wondering if some of these groups now are talking about, okay, so one of the criteria is we don't take corporate money. But what about also saying that all of our candidates should support electoral reform? Take, for example, the Fair Representation Act that's in Congress. You know, to me, that's a really exciting model because in one fell swoop, it would introduce independent redistricting, so and gerrymandering. It would bring in ranked choice voting, and it would bring in multi-member districts. So you basically have a form of proportional representation. And I think those are things that progressives can all agree that we would like to have, and that would make cooperation much easier. So
this is I love this question. And we, you know, when I was first going through this idea of the Incorporables with my friends, we were sort of a money and politics group, right? We were like, okay, we need to pass the Fair Representation Act, and we need to, you know, work with Represent Us and do all these things. And what we realized is that it's, and I helped pass public financing reform in Berkeley, California. So I worked on that campaign. It is incredibly difficult to get people, even people who know that electoral reform is necessary, it is incredibly difficult to get people to be on board for like canvassing, phone banking, actually working on those campaigns. And there's a whole discussion behind this, but it's kind of, you know, as someone for whom it is like my most important issue, I don't mean this in a bad way. I think it's the most crucial thing that we can do, but I think it's kind of a runt of the litter of progressive political silos. So it's incredibly difficult. It's way harder than you think to get people to agree to those things. And so our basic concept is get people elected and then have a wave of education among all those elected officials about, like, basically get them to pass all the reforms that Represent.us suggests in their own cities. So get it passed at the local level and begin educating people about how important that is. So it's crucially important, and I totally agree with you. I'm unconvinced that everyone can agree. Having worked on it myself, having been involved in trying to get people to work on those issues, people agree in the very abstract, but once it comes to actually putting their volunteer hours and their dollars on the line, money in politics tends to get less attention than other issues.
Well, the exception to that, of course, is open primaries, right? Lots of people are super hot about open primaries, which is really objectively no less or more dry than ranked choice voting. So I think we need to understand that institutionally and politically, what people are talking about does drive what people perceive to be as their organic interest. It's up to us to, you know, make our own luck on some of these issues and put our shoulder to the wheel if we're serious about real multi-party democracy and not just herding people into the Democratic Party.
Oh, yeah. And again, I believe me, like, I'm a money and politics person, so it's my number one issue, and I think it's crucially important, and it is the thing that will get us out of the horrible quagmire that we are in. I also happen to understand the difficulty of getting people to put their money and their volunteer hours on the line for that issue. So our role is get people elected and then get them to pass all these policies, rather than saying, we're going to be about these policies and you have to agree to these policies that are very abstract and a lot of people don't understand, before, as an obstacle between them and getting people elected. We want to get people elected and then be like, okay, great, now you need all this stuff. And to be honest, you know, I've been talking to the RPA, the Richmond Progressive Alliance. They are unconvinced about whether ranked choice voting is right for them. They're unconvinced about whether public financing of elections is right for them. And this is the Richmond Progressive Alliance. So, and they have their reasons why they are not convinced about these things. So
it's not as easy as you might think. The Richmond Progressive Alliance in Richmond, California.
Wow, we need one of those. The Rich and Progressive Alliance.
Well, I think one of the other bits of disconnect here comes, though, from the way that, electoral reform and issues of elections comes about and how people are engaged and become activists and involved and organizers. I mean, we get involved because of the issues and you know, the things that are happening in our communities. That, you know, you see Black Lives Matter, for instance, as a perfect model of people rising up in response to a bad policy. You don't see people coming into politics for the most part because they feel like the system of elections is wrong. That's something you get educated to as you become politically engaged. And I think that's one of the faults we have on the left is we don't talk about how the system is rigged against us from the onset. About how we get here, oops, I'm getting a little feedback. About how we get there, it isn't just, oh, we need to win on these issues. No, it's we have to change the way these things work. And so part of it is forcing these conversations in different communities and respecting the characteristics of different communities. Because I agree, the thing that Seattle's doing right now with the voucher-based campaign finance reform doesn't necessarily work in every community. But the key thing is finding out what does and forcing the conversation, I think, is the big thing.